I'm actually really glad that you had me on right now, because I feel like this has just become this zeitgeist that people are just all over. And every time they see a headline, they just accept it as a given. And, you know, part of me pounding the table on the whole dollar milkshake theory has not been to convince everybody to go all in on the US dollar and that it can never lose. A big part of me pounding the table on it is to convince everybody not to go all in against it.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Dire headlines predicting the end of the US dollar as the world's reserve currency have dominated the news in recent weeks. BRICS countries are announcing more and more trade deals that will settle in currencies other than the dollar. How serious a threat is this really to the dollar? And on what kind of timeline? For answers, we head to the dollar expert himself, Brent Johnson, CEO and portfolio manager at Santiago Capital and developer of the dollar milkshake theory, which was hands down one of the most powerfully explanative frameworks that define the action in global currencies in 2022. Brent, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, gosh, Brent, it's always a pleasure. I'm really looking forward to this conversation with you, particularly because I've been following you on Twitter. We've chatted a little bit. It sounds like you think that folks have lost their minds a little bit over this whole de-dollarization. So I want to give you a chance to clear the air. Before we tackle that topic, though, if we can just sort of start with a question I like to ask you every time you're on the channel. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, it's not great, to be honest. I mean, I could sit here and probably talk about the problems for, you know, an hour or two. They're kind of innumerable. They're all over the place. No one is immune and no one is innocent, I guess is the right way I would describe it. But that doesn't mean that markets won't continue to either go up or sideways for another year or 2 years. You know, unfortunately, I don't have a crystal ball. I've kind of coined the term violently sideways to describe the markets over, you could say, over the last year or the last 3 months, year to date, however you want to do it. You know, we haven't really broken out to new highs, but we're not sitting at the lows either. You know, one day the markets are up, 2 days later, the markets are down big. And, you know, a lot of people are trying to figure out why that is. But, you know, here we are. And, you know, I can give you a lot of reasons why things have gone up, and I can give you a number of reasons why they should go down. But, you know, nobody really knows.
Okay. We'll get into this in a bit, but I'm guessing that, you know, makes it a more challenging market to invest in. Although I think if you're a TA guy, maybe that's a great market because you can catch the swings.
Yeah, I've said this before and I really believe it. To me, I've been doing this for almost 25 years now, and it's the hardest environment I've ever seen. It helps a lot if you have a long-term horizon and you have a framework via which to work through. But if you're trading headline to headline, you're getting cut to ribbons right now. And there's no clear trend and there's no real clear answers. And like I said, you know, I can make a very good case for inflation. I can make a very strong case for deflation, and I don't know which one we're going to get. What I try to do is focus on understanding what could cause each of them. And then as we move forward in time, I can check these things off as we go along. But I continue to believe that, you know, sometime either late second quarter or second half of the year, we are going to have some kind of a shock or some kind of a risk off event. You know, whether that's lasts a week or whether it lasts 6 months, I don't know. But I don't think we have put all the storms behind us, and I don't think it's clear sailing from here.
Okay. Well, I do want to get into you about the framework that you're using to allocate capital, but that's going to come in a bit because we got some big topics to hit before then. And right before we get into de-dollarization, would you mind, for the folks that haven't watched videos of yours previously, may not be familiar with your dollar milkshake theory, if you could just give the, you know, the short version of it, and then I'll direct people to one of our past videos where we go into in depth. So if they want to get more, they can go there.
Sure. Well, essentially what the dollar milkshake theory is I believe the dollar is going to go much higher in the years ahead. But the dollar milkshake is not just about the dollar going higher. That's actually a rather small part of it. The reason I think the dollar is going to go higher is I think we're going to have a sovereign debt crisis and a currency crisis. Now, I've thought this for 4 years now, and we kind of got close to having one last year. You know, the powers that be were able to you know, steer the car back on the road and keep it going. But I still think that this is coming. And the dollar milkshake theory is a framework for the way I see that playing out. And essentially what it says is that for many reasons, some of them deserved, some of them undeserved, the United States capital markets and the U.S. dollar are the cleanest dirty shirts out there. And in a storm, you have to find this calmest relative port, you know, in which to hide out. And I think the United States and the U.S. dollar will be the safe havens during this currency crisis. I think it will push the U.S. dollar higher. And I think the capital flows coming into the U.S. will push U.S. asset prices higher. Now, I've said since the very first time I ever mentioned this idea that while I think those things will trend up high, and I think gold will go higher as well in the years ahead. So I've said I think the dollar is going higher, gold is going higher, and U.S. equities will go much higher. But I also said in the very first time I ever mentioned this, that this is not a story that ends well. It will create tremendous pain for the whole world, including the United States. And even though these prices will go higher, they will be characterized by terrifying drawdowns along the way. And I think if you look back over the last 3 or 4 years, that's exactly what we've had. The dollar's up, you know, tremendously since the global financial crisis, despite QE, despite bailouts, despite helicopter money, you know, the dollar's up like 15, 20% over the last 15 years versus its peers. Equities have, you know, tripled over that time period. Gold has gone up tremendously as well. But there have been some really scary times along the way. So I think overall the thesis has played out, or it is playing out now. Whether it will ultimately play out or not, I don't know. Until we get into a sovereign debt crisis, we won't really know, because that's what the theory is really all about. It's about a sovereign debt crisis. Now, if we get into a sovereign debt crisis and the U.S. dollar falls and other currencies are seen as a better safe haven than the U.S. dollar, then I'll be wrong. But I don't think that's going to happen, and it hasn't happened yet. And what I find a little funny with all the headlines and all the memes and the dollar bearishness right now is we are right now sitting almost exactly at the high from the COVID panic. So in 2020, when we had the COVID panic, you know, people for the previous 2 years prior to COVID said the dollar would never go back to 100. And then in the COVID panic, it went to 102. Now, subsequently there, it's gone to 115, and now it's pulled back to 102. But if you zoom out a little bit, we're right where we were, you know, 3 years ago at the height of the COVID panic. So it's not like the dollar is on death's door. And I think people are a little too eager, if that's the right way to say it, with what's happened over the last 6 months with regard to the dollar. And I think they very much want it to continue. And will it? Maybe it will. But I don't think that the dollar dies of weakness. I think the dollar dies of strength, and I think that will happen in the years ahead.
Okay. And really quickly, can you just touch on the importance of the euro dollar market to your theory? Because I think it's going to come into play when we talk about the de-dollarization movement.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is really key to it all. And for anybody out there who has studied the United States market in isolation and taken a look at the massive debts that we've run up and looked at the profligate government policies that we've had, and you realize that there's no way in hell we can ever pay off all this debt and we're going to have to print a bunch of money, I would say good job. You did a very good job analyzing the United States market. The problem is it's a very big world, and all of the other countries out there and all the other central banks are in the same situation. And in many ways, again, whether it's deserved or not, in many ways, they are worse off than the United States. And a big part of this is because of the euro dollar market. Now, what the euro dollar market is, this is not euros. We're not talking about the European currency. A dollar located outside the United States is considered a euro dollar. And this all goes back to the 50s, you know, post World War II, when they were rebuilding Europe, on into the 60s and 70s during the Vietnam War. Dollars were flowing around the world because it was the most currency in demand. The United States was the richest country. If you borrowed in dollars, you could get a lower rate than if you borrowed in local currency, obviously. And so then this whole market for dollars developed outside the United States. And that market, that euro dollar market, is bigger than the market for dollars inside the United States. And why that is important is that creates demand for the US dollar. Now, no other currency has this system and has this advantage that the US dollar has with the euro dollar system. Outside of Japan, nobody really needs yen. Now, maybe to a certain extent they do, but nowhere near on the scale of the US dollar. Outside of Europe, nobody needs euros. Again, are there exceptions? Of course. But in general, there's not a euro dollar market or a euro dollar market. Same thing for rubles and yen and yuan and reals and all these other foreign currencies. So when their central banks are printing or doing bailouts, they're basically doing it for their own domestic market. When the Federal Reserve does it, which is the US central bank, when they do it, they're doing it for the whole world. And that is why, for better or worse, why the US can quote unquote get away with it on a bigger scale than the rest of the world and not have their currency flitter away into nothing. Now, does that mean that the US dollar won't lose value versus hard assets? Probably not. Fiat currencies, all fiat currencies, whether it's the US dollar, the Brazilian real, or the Turkish lira, all lose value over time. Anybody who's studied the monetary system or different kinds of money knows this. But they will lose at different rates. And it is very important to understand that even if all fiat is getting debased, the relative level of fiat currencies does matter. And if you don't think it matters, it's probably because you live in the United States or Switzerland and your currency has held up pretty well versus some others. You can ask people in Egypt and Turkey and Argentina and Cyprus and Singapore, or not Singapore, Sri Lanka, Peru. You can ask all these places whether relative fiat currencies levels matter. And I assure you, they will say they do. So the euro dollar is a very, very big part of it. It creates demand for the US dollar that just no other currency has. And so if all currencies are getting printed, then what it really comes down to is an argument for demand. And the demand for the dollar is just higher than any other currency.
Okay, and I want to bring this into the next conversation, which is going to be about de-dollarization. But just to be real clear, what you're saying is the euro dollar market is this pool of dollars that exist outside of the U.S. that drive commerce and finance. Loans are being made, investments are being conducted, then they're having to repay those loans, and that creates demand for dollars. That pool of dollars outside of the US is actually bigger than the pool of dollars inside the US. And you're saying there's no other major fiat currency that has this dynamic. There's no euro yen market or euro yuan market right now that's doing something similar, right? So to de-dollarize, the world is going to have to come up with some substitute for this massive euro dollar market right now. But to your point, it doesn't seem like there's anything on the radar right now that could, correct?
Well, and it's it you have it exactly right, but it's a little incomplete, and I didn't explain all the aspects of it. But whenever I explain this to people, a lot of times what the answer I will get, well, okay, the rest of the world that owes all these dollars, they will just default on these loans or default on these dollar obligations, and therefore the demand will be, destroyed. And that is true. That would definitely destroy demand. The problem is it would also destroy assets. It would also destroy supply because every one person's loan is another person's asset. One person's liability is another person's investment. And the euro dollar credit, for the most part, is not owed to the United States. It's denominated in dollars, but it's not owed to the United States. It's owed to other entities in other parts of the world. It's a French bank making a dollar-based loan to a company in Turkey. It's a Japanese firm extending dollar-based credit to a supplier out of the Philippines. And so if these euro dollar credits or these euro dollar liabilities get defaulted on, that is the rest of the world defaulting on themselves. And so all of their assets will disappear along with it. And that would lead to a credit crunch. It's like a bankruptcy. If you have too many bankruptcies or too many, just go back to 2008 when, mortgages started failing and then one more mortgage started failing and it kind of went up the whole daisy chain all the way, to the country balance sheet. It's the same dynamic. And so for the rest of the world to get out from underneath this euro dollar system, they have to be willing to basically burn their assets at the same time. It's really easy to say in theory, but it's really, really hard to do in actuality.
Exactly. And not only burn their assets, but you burn trust, right? In fact, if you defaulted on your dollar denominated loan to me, if I'm the French bank and you're the Turkish guy who borrowed from me in dollars, why am I going to loan you a loan in some other currency?
Right.
You've just proven to
That's
me
right.
you're a defaulter, right?
That's right. That's right. And if maybe they will make them another loan, but the rates are going to be much higher. You know, they're going to be, you know, much more harsh, and they're going to, the payback terms are going to be much more difficult. So, you know, I think a lot of this de-dollarization, the zeal with which it is being reported, it's kind of understandable. I mean, the U.S. has been kind of a bully, right?
Right. We have an unfair advantage, no doubt.
Yeah, I don't deny that at all. And in fact, that's kind of a big part of my theory, is I think the bully is going to continue to be a bully. And I already know a lot of the objections I will get to this analogy. And the analogy is, well, yeah, it's just because nobody's ever walked up and punched the bully in the nose before, or whatever it is. And okay, fine. But the truth is that's kind of a nice story. But the reality is the way the bully got to be the bully in the first place is when the littler guy walked up and tried to punch him in the nose, the bigger guy punched him in the nose and knocked his teeth out and kicked him in the stomach while he's laying on the ground. And that's not a very popular thing to say, but that's the truth. You know, the reason that the bully got to be the bully is he was the biggest and the strongest and the meanest. And it's really hard to knock that guy off. Now, it's not impossible. It can happen, and it probably will happen at some point. I just don't think we're there yet. And I think the idea of knocking the bully off is so exciting that everybody feels like it's just a given that it will happen. And I just don't think that it's quite that simple.
Yeah. And so I want to take a step back and just let you start at the beginning of the de-dollarization story here. But one question I know I will have for you is, this in some ways is like the mice that are banding together to collar the cat, right? Or we want to put a bell on the cat, right? Who's going to go do it, right? And this narrative that, okay, you have all these, you know, countries, particularly those that are sort of, you know, not allied that strongly with the U.S., right? The Russias, the Chinas, the BRICS countries. Yes, there are lots of reasons for them to find solidarity and band together, but also, you know, you get countries there like, you know, Iran now doing deals with Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's just, there's a great question of like, how longstanding is the solidarity going to be amongst this right. cast of characters, right? They have a long history of not trusting each other, sometimes, you know, being at war with one another. Like, is this a confederation that's going to hold together tightly or not?
Well, you know, you could probably summarize it by, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And as long as that is the case, you know, makes strange bedfellows. And yeah, it can last for a little while, but that is a very important thing to point out. A lot of the, you know, China and Russia are historically rivals.
Right. And sorry to interrupt, I want you to include this in your answer, which is, yes, undoubtedly the U.S. has been a bully in a lot of different ways, but it's also been a massive force for, you know, good in the world and humanitarian aid, whatever. Like, I mean, the U.S. does a lot of nice things that countries like, too. So, you know, if the U.S. adopts more of a charm offensive, you know, it's going to be harder for these guys to all be, you know, aligned against the great Satan, if you will.
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, the it gets a little philosophical here, right? I mean, I think a lot of people like to try to be, you know, to feel like, you know, we've kind of ascended to this, you know, sophisticated era where, you know, we're all like woke and, you know, understanding of other people's feelings, and we just shouldn't do anything mean in the world. But that's just not reality. I mean, the history of the world, unfortunately, is the subjugation of one group of people by another group of people. You know, conquest and expansion of territory and, you know, the gaining of treasure, you know, you could, different tools have been used and different names have been used, but it's basically the same story over and over and over again. And some, you know, empires or regimes have been relatively, you know, nice and altruistic, and others have been horribly, you know, mean and vindictive and cruel. And where you want to put the U.S. on that scale, you know, I think that's open to interpretation. But the fact is that, you know, Pax Americana has led to the world being where it is today. You know, the shipping lane, you wouldn't be able to sit in Miami and order a printer from China and have it show up the next day on Amazon without, you know, a hegemonic power, you know, if it was a world that everybody was at war with each other, goods don't flow as easily, they don't flow as cheaply, and sometimes they don't flow at all. And so the optimization that the world had achieved, you know, think about pre-COVID, because this has all kind of started to disintegrate since COVID, but think about how efficient the supply chain was in 2019, leaving it up to 2020. I mean, there was times where I would order something and I would get it later that day or the next morning. It's crazy when you think about how hyper optimized it actually was. And it's still very good. It's still very good despite these problems that we're having. But, you know, I think it was, what was it, 10 years ago, you know, off the Horn of Africa, there was all of these, you know, ships that were basically getting hijacked, modern day pirates. Yep. And there was even a movie about it, Captain Phillips, and these, you know, disaffected youth and, you know, poor, you know, refugees off the east coast of Africa would commandeer these boats and they'd go out on these big oil tankers and they would come aboard with machine guns and they would hold these ships hostage. The group that put a stop to that was the United States Navy, right? That's what allowed those goods to continue to flow. And with that, you know, if the U.S. Navy hadn't done it, would somebody else have done it? Maybe, but who was going to do it? But that's a case where the U.S. did it. And, you know, that's kind of a small anecdotal example, but that is a big part of why the world has modernized as much as it has. Now, you can argue maybe the ends do not justify the means, but that we are there because of that, right? And I think to a certain extent, the U.S. gets too bad of a bad rap that's maybe not always deserved.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll maybe revisit this in a bit. But yeah, again, people can debate. But yeah, it's always easy to take pot shots as you know, at the leader. It's a great question, which is, you know, in a more bifurcated world, if you have an instance like that, or maybe, you know, keeping the Straits of Hormuz, you know, running safely every day, right? Is that going to be done by a confederation of Iranis and Chinese and Saudis? I mean, I don't know, right? But these are questions the world has to ask itself, which is, which system do I trust more, right? Exactly. All right. So again, taking a step back and just letting you start at the top here. So we've had this rash of headlines around de-dollarization. You know, I think well, first off, this has been something that has been going on for a long time, right? I'm trying to remember the stats. I'm probably not going to remember them entirely, but a couple decades ago, I think something like 70-something percent of world reserves were held as dollars. Now it's down to 59%, I think. The world has, I think, slowly been, you know, increasingly weaning itself off the dollar, but still very dependent on it. Then we had the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the weaponization of the U.S. financial system or the Western financial system against Russia. And many are saying, okay, that kind of accelerated a lot of countries' plans to de-dollarize because they're realizing, wow, I might be on the West's friendly list today, but tomorrow they might not like something I do. And I don't want to be that vulnerable to a tactic like that. Okay, you know, I get that. Feel free to chime in if you have a different perspective here.
I agree with you.
But these headlines are now, you know, basically positioning it as, okay, the world trade is, you know, quickly falling out of being done in dollars, and there's a new trade deal being announced every day. And of course, the headlines are now breathlessly saying, end of the US dollar, there's a world reserve currency, fracturing of world trade, you know, the sort of American / Western regime we've had, you know, maybe in its last days here. That, I think, is where you take exception and say, whoa, wait a minute, maybe that might happen someday. Maybe that is the trajectory, but this is sort of like global warming, right? Where like the glaciers don't melt in a day.
Yeah. And I'm actually really glad that you had me on right now, because I feel like this has just become this zeitgeist that people are just all over. And every time they see a headline, they just accept it as a given. And, you know, part of me pounding the table on the whole dollar milkshake theory has not been to convince everybody to go all in on the US dollar and that it can never lose. A big part of me pounding the table on it is to convince everybody not to go all in against it, right? I'm not suggesting that everybody sell everything they have, get a big pile of dollars, go hide out on a mountaintop in Montana and come back in 10 years. That's not it at all. But the fervor with people not just analyze and pay attention to these de-dollarization headlines, it's the extent to which they accept it as a given that kind of bothers me, because it's just not that simple. And I'll give you a very good example. These headlines, now, don't get me wrong, there have been more headlines recently than there has ever been before. I'm not blind to it. I'm not ignoring it. You have to pay attention to these things. But I can show you similar headlines from 5 years ago. I can show you similar headlines from 10 years ago. I can show you similar headlines from 30 years ago. This whole idea that Saudi Arabia is going to sell oil in something other than dollars has been discussed since the 1970s. I can literally remember reading about this in a newsletter that my father got in like the mid 80s. So this is not a new idea. If the dollar were to lose GRC status, this would not be a black swan. This would be the whitest swan in history, because there are entire industries that have been built up around the idea that the dollar is going to lose its global reserve status. But just because a headline says they're thinking about doing it or are considering doing it, it's much different than actually doing it. And I'll give you a real world example. Back in 2019, China entered into a deal with Iraq, where Iraq was going to provide oil to China. And in exchange, China was not going to pay for these in dollars. They were going to pay for them in services in kind. They were going to provide, you know, consulting services. They were going to provide construction. They were going to provide infrastructure. And what happened was, and, you know, and this was heralded as kind of a one of these end of the dollar. It's a new era. Nothing is ever going to be the same again. But what came out a few years later, and the truth of it, is that this deal that was signed or that was announced between China and Iraq really accounted for less than 10% of the exports of oil. And so it didn't end China paying in dollars, and it didn't change anything as far as the exports. And then it comes out that this deal was never actually implemented. So not only was the deal not for all of the oil that Iraq was selling to China, it was for a very small portion, but then it never actually ended up happening. But that didn't stop the headlines from going around. It didn't stop it being from heralded as a new era. And so that's what I would encourage people when they see these headlines. You know, it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to do it, right? You know, I've made this joke before, but I think it works. It's like, I've had a plan to get in shape and be, you know, run an Ironman for 30 years. I haven't done it yet, but it's on the board. I'm making the announcement, you know, but it's still a
resolution.
It's still a resolution. You know, I would really like to do it. I don't understand why I haven't. There's no reason why I can't. And I know I'm kind of, you know, making a joke about this, but I think it's a very serious topic. There's no doubt that the world is frustrated with the dollar system. There's no doubt that they would very much like to get out from underneath this weapon that the U.S. can use against the rest of the world. But it's just not as easy to do as say it. And if all it took was frustration and anger to de-dollarize the world would have been de-dollarized decades ago. But here we are, and it's more dollarized today than it ever has been before. That's unfortunately, that is just the truth. And I know many people don't like it, but that is the truth. And the reason I keep pounding the table on it is to help people survive the next 5 years, as opposed to blindly walking into what they think is a new era. And I just don't think it's going to be that simple.
Which is a great service, because you and I have been around long enough to see people, you know, different narratives of all stripes come up that everybody takes as okay, this is an imminent thing. And then they push all their chips onto that, and then it doesn't materialize, right? A couple of things. First off, let me ask you this. How much of these trade deals that are being announced right now are do you think more posturing than actual intent, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the intent is a good question because intent means the definite means of following through, or it means you intend to follow through. And I think they would like to follow through, but I just don't think that the ability is there, or at least not to the extent that everybody thinks, you know, that accepts these headlines. And here's part of the problem. And it's, again, part of the reason why I've pounded the table on this so hardly is that the process of de-dollarization is not necessarily, and I would say, I would remove the word necessarily, but in order to be open-minded, I will say not necessarily a negative for the price of the dollar. The process of de-dollarization is actually chaotic, and it causes lots of problems. And it may ultimately create a better system for the rest of the world, but the process itself is very chaotic. And because of the design of the system, when chaos reigns, I think the dollar rises. You know, we could go back to my Iron Man example, right? If I go out tomorrow and start training for the Iron Man, I am not going to be happy every day that I wake up over the next 30 days. Mm-hmm. In fact, I am going to be very pissed off and annoyed and sore, and I'll probably get injured at some point along the way. It's not going to be a simple process from, you know, from me being out of shape today to running an Ironman, you know, a year from now. And it's the same thing with de-dollarization. Like there's going to be some injuries along the way. Not only that, the U.S. will not just sit by and let the world do whatever it wants. Yeah, let's go back to the bully analogy, right? You know, let's use, for anybody out there who's a parent, let's pretend that you've got a couple 9 or 10 year old kids, and one day your son says, "I'm staying up until midnight," and you say, "No, you're not. You're going to bed at 9 o'clock," and he says, "No, I'm not. I don't have to do what you say." And you say something like, "Well, as long as you live in my house, you have to do what I say." And so then the next thing you know, your kid's at the front door. He's got his pillow and his toothbrush and his comic books, and he's running away, right? And he tells you he's running away. And maybe he'll get to the door. Maybe he'll get to the driveway. Maybe he'll even get a block away. But more than likely, he's going to turn around and come back when he realizes how scary the world is, right? It's kind of the same thing. You know, it's just, you know, these countries that are saying they're going to de-dollarize and no longer do business with the United States, that's fine. You can go out on your own, but then you're not going to sell into our markets anymore. You know, your second or your biggest customer is probably the United States. If it's not the biggest, it's certainly your second or third biggest customer. Well, you can say goodbye to that customer. And I don't know too many businesses that go gangbusters when they lose their second or third biggest customer. You know, and then they'll say, "Well, okay, well, you know, I just won't sell to them anymore." Okay, well, then who are you going to sell to? Okay, well, then I'm going to go sell to Europe. Well, okay, but if we're going through this de-dollarization and there's all these problems, and now Europe's in a recession because if the dollar's falling and their currencies are going higher, that's putting pressure on their economy. So now they're in a recession. So now you're not selling as much to Europe anymore either. You know, it's just, there's all of these ways that this can put pain on the person who is trying to de-dollarize. And then as their currency or their country starts to come under, you know, trouble, and they're having trouble getting dollars, just like everybody did last year, and the U.S. comes and says, "Hey, I know you were going to run away. We said some things we didn't probably really mean. I'm going to give you a swap line and I'm going to give you some dollar funding, and it'll help you get some currency, and it'll help you import needed food and needed energy, and it'll help get the inflation down in your country, and the political blowback that you're seeing at home will help you with that." The leaders of those countries probably going to say, "Yeah, you know what? Maybe that doesn't sound so bad." Just like your kid who's a block away says, "Yeah, maybe I don't want to sleep outside in the rain. Maybe I want to go back to my bedroom and I get my allowance and I can get some ice cream." And, you know, it's kind of like that. And if they don't do that, the parent at some point is going to come out there, grab their kid, throw them in the back of the truck, and take them back home and throw them in their room, right? And You know, the U.S. has a history of doing that as well. So I guess my point is even if the rest of the world decides that no matter what the case, we are going to de-dollarize, the U.S. has a say as well. Now, the U.S. may lose, but they have a say, and they're the biggest guy on the block. So you just have to factor that in.
That's a great analogy, Brent. Well, look, on that vein, there's a lot of talk about a new BRICS currency that's going to potentially be commodity backed. And let's not even say it's going to displace the dollar as the world's reserve currency, but it's going to become just a competing currency on the world stage. What kind of credence do you give those reports?
Without being too like just dismissive of it, I don't give it much credence. Again, not because the desire's not there, but to actually pull it off, you've got to get these five or six countries to agree on how they're going to do it, who's going to implement it, and who's going to enforce it, right? That in itself is, first of all, the BRICS have been around since 2009. They were formed almost at the bottom of the crisis in 2009. Since that time, the Chinese yuan is roughly even with the US dollar. I think it's lost 1 or 2%. But the Brazilian real, the Indian rupee, what's the other one? The South African rand, and what's I'm losing Russia. One. Which one am I missing? The Brazilian ruble, real, or the Russian ruble, right? Those are all down over 50% versus the US dollar over that time period. So my thing with this BRICS currency, this basket of BRICS currencies, and even if they back it with gold and oil, my argument is to people, if you believe that this is the future, you don't need to wait. You can go buy those five currencies and gold and oil right now. And you can get rid of all your dollars. And you can go to that currency right now. And then when that currency becomes real, you'll be ahead of the game. You'll be ahead of everybody. So what I recommend, everybody who thinks this is actually going to happen, go sell all your dollars, buy those five currencies, put gold and oil in there, and let's see how it does. And again, it's very easy to say, but how many people out there are saying Brent is full of crap? You know, he is so wrong. The world is going to de-dollarize. How many people are actually going to go out and buy those five currencies and get rid of all their dollars? Very few. Now, they may like the idea, but just actually doing it is a whole other ballgame. And somewhat related to this is there's this idea that sanctions don't work. And I will agree that in the long term, sanctions don't work. And you could argue that a big reason that we've had this blowback and all this effort for de-dollarization over the last, call it, year is because the U.S. weaponized the dollar and put sanctions on Russia. And the rest of the world is saying, holy cow, I don't want that to happen to me. I need to come up with an alternative plan. Okay. I actually agree with that. There's definitely truth to that, and I'm on your side. However, to say that sanctions do not work, just completely throw them out of the window, I think I would direct you to the GDP and the living standard in Venezuela. I would direct you to the GDP and living standard in Iran. Same in Cyprus. Same in Russia. Russia. All of these, you know, these are places that had sanctions put on them at various times over the last 5 to 10 years. And while they haven't become a complete disaster in some cases, they certainly haven't kept up with the rest of the world as far as growth and standard of living. And the reason is because sanctions do have an effect. Now, they might not work perfectly, and there will definitely be blowback to the person who implements these sanctions, which the U.S. is definitely feeling. But to say that they just absolutely do not work and that there is no point in doing them, I think is to miss the game a little bit. I mean, right now in Russia, their revenues, the oil and gas revenues have fallen tremendously. They made a lot of money last year, but in the last 6 months, as oil prices have fallen and natural gas prices have fallen, the energy industry's revenues have fallen tremendously. And as a result, the Russian tax receipts have fallen tremendously. So much so that the Russian Ministry of Finance has had to change the way that they calculate taxes and tax their producers because they are now running one of their biggest budget deficits in years. And so, you know, again, it's not that the rest of the world can't do anything about it. It's not that the rest of the world is helpless to fight against the US. There's lots of things they can do. They have lots of resources and they have lots of power that they can use. But the idea that the US is helpless and cannot enforce its will anymore and cannot build a coalition of the willing, especially of the Western nations, I think people are just getting too far too quickly with this notion. And you know what we haven't seen for a very long time? We saw it a little bit post 9/11. We probably saw it for 3 or 4 years. But the world has not seen an angry, pissed off hegemon for a very long time. And I kind of feel that's where it's headed. And if and when that, and the reason I laugh is because if I don't laugh, I cry. I mean, this could get very dark very quickly. But my point is that the guy on top of the mountain is not willingly just going to walk down the mountain. He's just not, or she's not. You know, power is never given away. It's always taken. And, you know, if the U.S. actually ever feels threatened, like their supremacy is literally being threatened, they will use every tool in their, you know, toolkit to keep their relative space on top of the mountain. And so for the rest of the world to be going through a project as hard as de-dollarization, even under the best circumstances, would be extremely difficult to do. If they do it while the U.S. is pissed off at them and actively trying to stop them from doing it, it makes it even more so.
Okay. And the, you know, my assumption there is you're saying, look, if the BRICS came up with a competing currency like this that was designed to diminish the dollar's hegemony, the U.S. eventually at some point will wake up and say, wait a second, I'm beginning to get pissed about this and I'm going to start playing dirty.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, so, and yeah, okay. It's just, yeah, unfortunately, I think that is the real world. That is the, you know, when you strip away all the niceties and all the, the window dressing, right? That's real politic. That's when the rubber really hits the road. I mean, the U.S. has run the world for 100 years, and they are not going to willingly cede that position. They're just not. You know, you may wish that they would, and you may think that they should, but they're not going to do it.
All right. A couple follow-up questions on this. One is, look, all reserve currency regimes in history to date have come to an end, right? I mean, in some cases, it's taken a century or two. I don't get the sense that you're not saying the world may not continue to de-dollarize to the point where the dollar is no longer the world reserve currency. I just hear you saying it's going to be a long and painful road. Under the best of scenarios, and it's probably going to be measured, I'm going to use these words, correct them if not, in at least decades. So I'm kind of curious, do you think it, no, let me ask this differently. What's the probability that you would put on it happening in our lifetimes? So you and I are in our early 50s, right? So, you know,
unfortunately,
is it something we could see before we shake off this mortal coil? Or you think it's
I think we will probably see multi. I think we'll probably see multipolarity in our lifetimes. Whether we see a new global reserve currency, whether we see a new unipolar global currency in our lifetime, I think that's probably a bit of a stretch. I do think this is going to take much longer to play out than most people think. The soonest I could think it would play out with it would be within a couple of years. And I think it's more likely, you know, 5 to 10 easily.
I'm sorry, which is 5 to 10?
Maybe in 5 to 10 years, we've moved to a kind of a multipolarity state, okay. But I don't think in 10 years, the US is going to be no longer a global reserve currency, at least one of them. Right.
Okay. And sorry to interrupt, but just for folks watching, can you define multipolarity? Is that just more trade is being done in yuan and
I think we're probably headed back towards at least attempting multipolarity, where maybe China and Russia, you know, exert the influence over their region, and maybe Brazil kind of influences, you know, South America a little bit. And so maybe, you know, as the unipolar only global real superpower right now, the U.S. in that position, I think maybe that goes away within 10 years. But I think it's going to be very, I think it's, I just think it's, I think to even get to that point, it's going to be very chaotic. And I want to make this point because this is actually important. And I know when I talk about these things, because we haven't even really talked about too much finance right now, right? Yeah. A lot of it's been kind of politics and geopolitics and military stuff, really. And whenever I talk about this part, people will often label me a jingoist or an American exceptionalist, or that I am I advocating the use of the military to keep our position in the world. And, you know, I have a 14-year-old son. You know, 4 years from now, he's going to be prime age. So the last thing I want to see is a war. And the last thing I want to see is kids on the other side of the world getting hurt as well. So I don't advocate for any of this, but I think it's coming, right? And I think the idea that we're going to transition to a new world and we don't have to think about these kind of things, I think it's wrong. And I think it's important to think about that, because global reserve currencies are not really about economics. You know, there's this idea out there now that the U.S. would be better off if they didn't have the global reserve currency. You know, they could reshore some of their industry. We could bring back jobs. We wouldn't have to be subservient to the rest of the world for our supply chains.
We could run a result, trade surplus.
Yeah, we could. Exactly. And so it would be to our benefit to give up the global reserve currency. And from an economic perspective, that makes a lot of sense. The problem is the global reserve currencies are not about economics, at least not for the home nation. What I mean by that is the global reserve currency from the US perspective is power. It is the ultimate weapon. And it allows the US to get away with things that nobody else can get away with. Now, for the rest of the world, it means they're somewhat subservient to the United States, but from them, it is more of an economic thing, because they have to consider the economics of another country being able to print their currency for hard goods, even though their country cannot do that. But at the end of the day, global reserve currencies, it's a power position. It's a power decision. It's not an economic decision. And no country is going to willingly give it away. It's just, if it never say never, but that's about as close to an impossibility as I can think of.
Okay. Well, look, I do actually want to trundle into economics and markets for a second, because
If I've been a little dark, I apologize. But
Look, I want to give you credit. You to me, Brent, feel like the meteorologist who everybody is beating on because they want their own particular forecast, right?
Yeah,
sunny skies, right? You know, I want it to be warm, right? And you're just saying, look, folks, I'm just calling it as I see the data, right?
Yeah.
All right. So, but before I get over there, because I do want to, you know, hear how you're allocating capital in this type of environment. Real quick, and this might be even a bridge to a certain extent. So when we're talking about world reserve currencies and multipolarity and all that type of stuff, we're still living in the world of fiat currency, right? And, you know, you've used every analogy out there, cleanest shirt in the hamper, you know, best looking horse in the glue factory, all that stuff. But they all are fiat currencies. What is your general outlook for the whole basket, you know, from the strongest to the weakest? In your assessment, what are you benchmarking against? Is it gold? Is it something else?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've said this for years now, that I think ultimately gold is going to go much, much higher. And in the race of fiat currencies versus gold, I expect gold to ultimately be the winner. You know, over time, fiat currency loses value. That's the reason governments like fiat currency, right? You kind of have to look at incentives. If the governments wanted a currency that didn't lose value, and that put shackles on them, and that was a good store of value, they would use gold, right? But they don't want that. They don't want those shackles. They don't want the citizens to be able to store value in a currency. They don't want to have handcuffs on them, so they don't use gold. And so currencies, fiat currencies, all fiat currencies over time are going to lose value. What I think in general, I think in the years ahead, fiat currencies around the world, not just the US dollar, much like we saw last year, we're going to see fiat currencies lose value versus real things. So I think we will see inflation. However, I think there will be periods. Remember, I talked about how I thought asset prices would rise over time, but they would be punctuated by drawdowns along the way.
Yep.
I think in general, we're going to see inflation in the years ahead. We have to, for the system to survive, we have to have inflation. Again, doesn't mean I want that. That's just the way the system is designed. But I think we're going to see deflationary scares along the way. And I think that that's what we're going to have sometime in the second half of this year, or could be tomorrow. I don't know. But I think for us to get to the next phase where, you know, the money printer go burr or the bailouts or the stimulus, however you want to, the helicopter money, I think for us to get to that next stage of or next round of that, we need to get a deflationary scare. That would give, think about the politics of announcing QE right now. If they came out and announced QE right now with inflation still at high single digits and, you know, it would be political suicide for the Fed to do that. And the government, they might ultimately like that, but politically it'd be very hard for them to do.
Right.
But and if there's a scare,
what's left of the Fed's credibility.
Right. But if there's a scare and markets go down 20 or 30% and a bunch of layoffs happen and bankruptcies, that then gives them the cover to come in and say, okay, we're going to save the day. We're going to go back to whatever it is, you know, whatever new program they come out with. I don't think they're going to be as quick to do that as most people. And so I still think that we are going to get one of these deflationary scares before we get the next dramatic move higher in risk assets. Now, can I be wrong? I can absolutely be wrong. I don't advocate just selling everything and sitting in cash right now. I know you've asked me kind of how I'm allocating capital.
Our interview with Brent will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as the little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And don't forget that the replay videos of Wealthion's very excellent online conference from last month are still available for purchase at wealthion.com/conference. And finally, if the challenges that Brent has detailed in this interview have you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends, risks, and opportunities that Brent has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next over in part two of our interview with Brent Johnson. Thank you.